Shockwaves is brought to you by the following advertisers. Fright Rags is the number one source for your horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. Brand new this week, an all-new Happy Death Day collection is available now, featuring new shirts, socks, and an enamel pin. Coming May 22nd, the first collection of officially licensed Hammer Horror, featuring a classic Christopher Lee Dracula, Frankenstein, and more. And our Shockwaves listeners can save 10% now at checkout by entering promo code WAVES10. Again, that's WAVES10 to save 10% off at checkout. Visit fright-rags.com for more.
Hey guys, next weekend, Elric and I will be at Phoenix Fan Fusion. We will be hanging out at a booth, and we will also be doing a ridiculous amount of panels.
They actually sound fun, because usually when we go to these things...
Usually when I think they sound like a blast.
We just interview people, or we... This is like us on topic.
It's one of the reasons that I love going to Phoenix Fan Fusion, because instead of just us interviewing people, which is usually a blast anyway, but this one, some of our topics include bold horror statements, best horror scenes
That's
what ever.
I'm most excited about, best horror scenes.
PowerPoints?
No, I'm not doing PowerPoints for this one. But actually, we are doing for the best scenes. We are showing the scenes.
Oh yeah, we'll see some scenes.
And we're doing horror social commentary. You're on one that's like representations of disabilities in horror. Yep. And so, yeah, there are just some really fun panels there. And while we are in Phoenix for Phoenix Fan Fusion, we are also doing a half of Shockwave screening at the Phoenix Film Bar in downtown Phoenix. And we will be showing Society. And
but only half of Society.
Only half.
Only the second half. It's going to leap right into the second half of that movie.
And this is on Saturday, May 25th at 8 p.m. We're going to show Society, and then we'll stick around and do a little post commentary and talk about it. And then after that, you will have exactly 1 hour to get over to Dead Right Horror Trivia Night, which we're having back at the convention, which is a whole 5-minute walk, so you should be able to make it.
I thought this was a holiday.
No!
I'm going to be worked.
It is so much that we have going on in Phoenix next weekend, so please check out Phoenix Fan Fusion, both the convention and all the fantastic horror panels, and also the film bar for the screening of Society.
You too have fun.
I call it my makeup tour for Phoenix, because last year I totally like pulled out of Phoenix.
You mean when I went alone?
Yes, when you went alone.
Yeah, we felt
I was in hospital,
Let's
Phoenix.
Say that.
I'm coming back for you.
Wow.
Go Phoenix Suns.
Okay, welcome to episode 145 of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob G. I'm sitting here with Elric Kane.
Hey, man.
What's up, man?
Hey, what's up, Lefty?
Half an audio. What's up, Lefty? Inside joke.
Yeah.
Ryan Turek's here.
What's up, Chubby Rain?
It's going to be all inside jokes.
This is all inside jokes the whole time.
Rebecca McKendry's here, too.
Hi, guys.
Just so you know, we were just talking about Bowfinger. That's the Chubby Rain reference, which is one of my favorite movies.
You know what's really good? So Apocalypse Now.
Good. Apocalypse, yes. That. And we're only getting audio out of our left ear. That's why we're all calling each other.
We're all kind of leaning
We're all doing the cool singer thing where you only put the headphones on half the side.
Yeah. Yep.
And then you kind of rock out into the microphone like that. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Which is actually
actually
suits our guest later, guys.
Oh, that's true.
So it's all on point.
There you go.
Wow, look at
that.
It connects,
baby.
Didn't even intend to do that.
Yeah,
so a lot going on. It's been been a hell of a week. Been a hell of a couple of weeks.
I'm done with these headphones.
Elric gave up on the headphones. He's going.
Going rogue.
Ryan's singing.
I was singing this song for Boogie Nights.
Oh man,
Jesus!
That's already off the rails.
Come on.
Ryan, you're going to be a big star.
You bet.
All right. Anything anybody wants to talk about before we just dive right into what we've seen?
I got a new podcast, guys.
You do?
Nightmare University on the Fangoria Podcast Network. Please check it out. It's super eggheady academic stuff. Every other week. So yeah, definitely.
First episode with Josh Miller and Steve Scarlatta.
Thank you.
And I feel like we should do a crossover episode with them. where we only talk about unmade horror movies.
I was, I don't know if I can announce yet, but I was just recorded and unmade. I was just on theirs this past week talking about Del Toro's In the Mouth of Madness.
Ooh.
At the Mountains of Madness, talking about the Del Toro never made script. And I read it.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I would love to do a crossover.
Yeah, if you haven't heard it, I did it a few weeks ago, and we did Freddy versus Jason versus Ash. But in getting to that, we talked about the history of Freddy versus Jason, which is like 11 scripts. And of course, Steve Scarlatta has read them all. So his deep cuts of things that happen in the script and what he loves about them. I mean, he's just a wealth of unmade horror knowledge.
I love Steve Scarlatta, because when he came on the first episode of Nightmare U, I had heard that there was a Leviathan script floating about that it included stuff that had never been put in the movie. And Steven came on not only having read it, but researched it and compared scenes. And I was like, you have a lot of time, sir. Wow. This is impressive.
It's totally wonderful. Yeah. I think they're doing they're going to do Spider-Man 4 and it turned into a 4-part episode. Oh, wow. Unmade Spider-Man movies, Tobey Hooper's and all that. Anyway, best movies never made. So now we're plugging multiple podcasts.
Yes, multiple podcasts.
Oh, wow. If we're going to do that, let's not forget Eli Ross. Heart. It is one of the greatest 2 hours ever just hear Quentin going riffing on horror for 2 hours.
I'm still getting through it. I feel like it's taken me 2 or 3 weeks to get
through.
I think
I have title.
It's very good.
We want to find
it's just unedited. Yeah, it's the History of Horror documentary series, and these are the unedited.
The raw.
The raw.
They're releasing just the audio, and they've put out Edgar Wright and King.
So Stephen King was first. Edgar Wright, Quentin Tarantino, and Diablo Cody
just went out.
And I haven't heard any of the others. It's just because you had told me originally this was up.
Oh, as soon as it came up, he made a New Zealand reference.
Yeah, within minutes of Utu. But but there's this part on King Kong that is just brilliant.
That's the part
I'm
at.
It's brilliant. And so he's he's kind of flipping about a lot of things. And I think because it's not on exploitation, I'd love to have heard him go on grimy exploitation horror.
My God.
But this is very much about the questions.
What's interesting is the things that that Quentin Tarantino has not seen.
Oh, yeah.
When he owns up and he's like, oh, yeah, I haven't seen Rosemary's Baby in its entirety.
Rosemary's Baby. 6 years
ago. Until recently.
Yeah.
And then he's it's one of the best films. And now he's it's one of the best films. But I really respect that about him. And it comes up a lot on shows like this or Pure Cinema where there's this people feel like they have to pretend like they've seen everything. Yeah. It's so cool when a guy like that, who's got more deep cuts than any of us, will say, yeah, I never got to see that. Or I didn't like, he didn't like The Haunting. And
the original
He doesn't like a lot of classic things. He's just like, that's boring and that doesn't do it for me. And it's very interesting.
I have a love-hate thing with it because we've ever wanted since we started Even Killer PD is just him to talk horror with us for 2 hours. And now Eli's pretty much gotten – what else is there to know?
Oh, no. We're still getting on.
The fact that he thinks the last 20 minutes of The Mutilator is the greatest.
Yeah, no, that was awesome. He loves that.
Those kind of nuggets, you're I get it.
But I do think – I think they're not exploring a lot. So I do think you could get into exploitation horror with him and it would be really interesting.
Yeah, I think we could definitely go a lot more niche.
Yeah, but it was interesting. It was just cool. It's really cool. And also Eli's such a fan. I think that comes across better in this than it does on the series. I love the series, but you don't get to – Eli's just kind of moving it along. Yeah. In this, you get to hear him geek out, and it's nice to hear.
Absolutely, And the Edgar Wright one I do want to throw some love
it's
at,
really
too,
good.
Because he is so eloquent and well-spoken about every – if there was something that he wasn't very familiar with, he'll be he'll steer it in the right direction.
Oh, yeah.
The interviewer had asked him about The Howling, and he threw a little bit of love at The Howling, but then he took it on track of American Werewolf in London and went on about that, which was great.
And a lot of Don't Look Now, which you'll
probably love. And Stephen King was very good too.
Okay.
Stephen King was great. It was nice to get a double dose because Mick Garris had King on for
which
the
I'm savoring. That's my next on my list too.
It was interesting to hear King, talking about, he's like, it's great that everybody's embracing horror these days, but it's supposed to be for us misfits, It's supposed to still feel down and dirty and, an unpopular thing to get into. I just needed to hear you say that, Stephen.
There's one quote that came out of that, which is my favorite Stephen quote now of ever, which was he's like, I can't remember exactly, I'm going to paraphrase, but he said, even the shittiest horror movie is still the greatest fucking movie I've ever seen.
Yeah.
That's exactly how we all feel.
Yep, that's it exactly.
Yeah, it's a very good listen.
So, all right. Well
also, we could nickname that the guest we'll never have on Shockwave. Yeah. Stephen King and Quentin are probably two of the ones
we're
really
excited.
You never know.
It's been a few years. We've been trying. 7 years in. Anyway.
But you can get those.
Hey, it's
those
nice that it's out
terrific.
There.
Terrific. Yeah. All right. Who wants to dive in?
Ryan
Watched some more cat movies.
I did not watch most of the movies. No, I spent the weekend. I'm going through all the Friday the 13th.
Oh, cool. Oh.
So I spent the weekend going through
don't
one and two.
Don't read into that, listeners.
No, don't read into that at all.
I feel like I need to.
No, I do. I dip into them like once a year, and I go through them all. And I'm going to end the series by watching I'm blanking on the name. Never Hike Alone, the short film that around. Yeah, so I'll cap it with that. But yeah, I watched one and two. Two, you know what? It's so funny because my favorite Fridays like tend to adjust with each
revisit. Yeah, I think everyone has that a little bit.
Now three, which I started rewatching just before we recorded this. You know, I love the Jason from three, and I kind of like the kind of mean-spiritedness of three. But two has passed it now. Like usually my top five is like Friday 6, Friday 3, you know, da, 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 da. But now 2 has surpassed 3 in a sense that I think that they just got the kids right. Mm. The kids, like the counselors, I should say,
yeah.
Who are in a training camp in Friday 2. They're just so good, you know.
It's also Ginny is fantastic. Like it works tension wise well, I think.
Yeah. There's a great moment where Ginny like walks into the room and she gets a sense that Jason's in there, and she's like, "Paul, somebody's in this fucking room." And then like Jason comes out, and it's like, "Fuck, man, I jumped a little bit." Yeah, you know?
That's a great.
But
moment.
I'll kind of recap after I'm all done. But the one thing that I do want to talk about, and this is a film that I would call a new classic, a film that I think people need to revisit at least once a year and just hyper analyze. And I'm not seeing enough think pieces out there these days, and I'm not seeing as much love thrown at it as I did like a while ago. But Starship Troopers.
Oh yeah, wow.
Starship Troopers. I had a hankering to watch really late at night, and it was just meant to be like one of those, I'm just going to fall asleep watching Starship Troopers. Now, Ciara and I were up like till like 3 a.m. watching this fucking movie. That movie is just as relevant now as it was in 97, 98 when it came out. It works so well as, you know, it's a movie that's got an identity shift. It begins as a typical teen like sci-fi drama, you know, and then it becomes a full-on war movie. And because the
propaganda
war movie.
Yeah, talk about horror as social commentary. I mean, he's saying so much about like xenophobia and everything.
So much. I mean, well, the great thing is like you see the news reporter like talking to the camera and he's like, yeah, the bugs have a live and let live policy. And some experts say that they wouldn't even be fighting back if it wasn't for us. And it's like, oh yeah, we instigated the whole war to begin with, you know? But it's because of that, you know, that kind of setup. You care for these characters quite a bit, you know? I mean, like Rico and what's her face from Wild Things. Yeah. I mean, like everybody, you know, Diz. Yeah. You really care for these kids. So when the bodies start dropping, I felt bad when Dizzy died, you know? But it's, and the bug effects are so fantastic, and you really feel the stakes of the battles. Michael Ironside is fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, it's just one of those movies, and oh my God, the score is so good.
Yeah.
So good. And also, I spotted Travis Stevens. Producer Travis Stevens is actually
in
Starship Troopers.
Get out of here.
What?
That's pretty fun. Mm-hmm. I did not know that.
Yeah. The scene where, I'm blanking on his name. What's his face? Throws the knife at the wall at Busey's kid, and the knife gets stuck in his hand. The camera follows him over the shoulder, and then you see Travis standing off to the side, like looking perplexed, like, oh my God, I can't believe he did that. And I was like, oh, there's Travis Stevens.
What's he, a soldier?
Uncredited.
He's one of those, he's one of the soldiers.
And if you happen to head out to ADI Effects Warehouse, they have one of the brain bugs.
One of the brain,
Yeah, because I'm assuming that they worked on it, but they have like one of the brain bugs up like a mantelpiece on the wall. Yeah. It's beautiful.
It's so good. The movie
we're going to have to get Travis on now because his movie's coming out, and we'll ask all about
that. Tell us about
how Verhoeven was.
Yeah.
I love Verhoeven, always have, one of my favorites, and his films are always smart. There's always two layers to it. That's why when you don't get one, like I still don't necessarily get Showgirls, even though there's probably something
it's
else
brilliant.
There.
It's brilliant. It's seriously brilliant.
A lot of people think that, and it's
a big documentary coming on.
Right. So I'm always curious.
I have the goal, or whatever. That's one that I will always buy. whatever upgrade edition. They make, I will always buy the most recent edition. Like I have like the gold sparkly edition.
I remember
right
seeing
now.
It in theaters and going, "What just happened?"
I have the blue.
Oh, it's amazing.
What just happened?
Yeah, Ellery, if you want to come over for Love 3D,
all right. Oh man,
talk about
I actually want to start with Showgirls, so we get that build up, and then we get the release with Love 3D.
Just know that working in the dance industry and even just being female, Showgirls is just as smart as Starship Troopers.
Okay.
So
it's good to hear.
And you know what that
it is.
Okay.
There is so much wonderful stuff going on in that.
It's one of those rare movies where I don't know why the CG works as well as it does, but it does.
It works.
We've been bombarded by so much CG from that era, and then Starship Troopers still kind of holds up.
The bugs hold up great. The kind of interstellar spaceship stuff, it works okay. But the bug stuff still looks great. And what was so disheartening to see is that after you kind of ride the thrill of revisiting Starship Troopers, and then the iTunes menu screen comes back up, it's like,
all the sequels.
Oh, here's Starship Troopers 2, here's Starship Troopers 3, Marauder, here's the animated Starship Troopers. And it was like, man, they really just fucking raked that through the mud. They really tainted that.
The point of the first one being a
satire. Oh, they're so awful. I watched the
sequels.
I watched the trailers for all of them, and I was like, why did they do this?
Yeah.
Because you could do an effective follow-up that's just like just as poignant and just as gnarly and cool and violent today. And Jesus, I mean,
wasn't
like,
that interesting? That's a Verhoeven thing, because the last time I saw it, Starship Troopers, it was on a double bill with RoboCop at the New Beverly. And seeing RoboCop first and then Starship Troopers, it's like that was an incredible double bill. And that's the thing. Like, both of them captured a certain satirical thing that is totally missing from all the sequels. Like, yeah, there's things I like about RoboCop 2, but it's like there's nothing in those sequels or even the TV movies they made that even match Verhoeven's movie.
And the same can be said of the Showgirls sequel, which was an unofficial sequel called Pennies from Heaven.
Two and a half hours long.
Speaking of killer bugs.
Yes. But
I watched Slugs. Thank you for that. Why are you pointing at me?
But that was a big game show point, though. It was like, speaking of Slugs, let's see what's behind this curtain.
She had to look at her notes for that.
So now I'm on the British podcast coming up, Strong Language and Violence, talking about Slugs.
Snugs.
And so I rewatched Slugs. I will start by saying, though it's not hard, Chernobyl is by far the scariest thing I saw this week.
Been hearing about that.
That shit fucked me up. My God. Yeah. So, and I will also say that last week's episode of What We Do in the Shadows was the most brilliant.
Oh, so good.
So good.
So good. Well, so we were all alive, and like when did that happen? 85?
85 for Chernobyl.
So I was 9, and that shit was scary.
I remember hearing about
it. I thought that shit was going to creep over to the East Coast, and I was like, are we doomed or what?
And I remember, that was right around the same time that my mom was watching all of these nuclear Holocaust movies, like The Day After Tomorrow, and there was one called After the Rain, I remember, about people who were waiting for the nuclear rain to come, and they're literally just waiting for it. The morning after, there was just a whole bunch of these movies, and I remember catching glimpses of them and then hearing about that and being like, oh God, we're all going to die.
Yeah, as a kid, when you hear about the Chernobyl disaster, like your brain goes into overdrive and you're thinking so many things because of not just what you were exposed to on television or what you were watching in the movies, because during that time you were watching movies about, you know, nuclear fears and stuff like that. Yeah. I remember watching Dreamscape, and the whole thing was a president who was they were trying to prevent another world war, you know, and it was like a family running from a nuclear blast, and like that ingrained in your brain.
My understanding of nuclear, like what it did to you, was from The Stand. The guy who was driving cross country with a nuclear warhead, trash can. And by the time he gets there, his like teeth are missing and he's all fucked up and kind of just dissolved. That was like my understanding.
But it made for a wonderful shooting location for Return of the Living Dead 4 and 5. So there's that. Do you remember that when that news came out? I remember going, what? Like, we're going to
it's
Chernobyl.
Like a Sands of Iwo Jima
shoot Return of the Living Dead 4. I remember it because it was Elokaim, who's a Kiwi. Yeah.
Who did Alien 3.
Not Sands of Iwo Jima. What was the movie that...
Chernobyl Diaries?
No, there was a movie that John Wayne shot on
It was
the Genghis Khan one.
It was Genghis Khan, and everyone who worked on it got cancer and died.
Everyone
who worked on it. It's like fame because of the radiation.
It was the Genghis Khan
in Arizona. It was during a testing site where they shot it.
But
it's like one of those terrible legends where it's like, you know, 20 years later, almost everyone on this crew, I mean, It's just, yeah, of course,
brutal.
The radiation.
But yeah, so slugs. If you're not watching Chernobyl, yeah,
slugs leave.
So yeah, what was the review? Slugs or Chernobyl?
So no, well, I was saying it's the scariest thing I'm watching right now. So cool. Chernobyl Diaries is completely fucked up. What We Do in the Shadows was brilliant this week. I rewatched Slugs. 1988. This time I've seen Slugs a lot, but I probably haven't watched it in like 10 years.
By the director of Pieces, for those who don't realize, that's worth watching.
I love this director. Like He's The fun. Rift he did. He has his Lovecraft movie Cthulhu Mansion. Like
that one
they're
I haven't
seen. It's fun. Okay. I mean, don't expect a lot of Cthulhu in it, but it's fun. So yeah, John Picare Simon, who when he did Slugs, they shot it in upstate New York, and it was supposed to be his like big first American film. He shot it under J.P. Simon. J.P. Simon. But yeah, this one, it's got this now that I'm watching it, knowing that they shot half in Spain and half in upstate New York, you can literally watch it. And like every 5 minutes, they teleport to Madrid. Oh, nice. So it's like, it's very clear where they're suddenly like, wow, that does not look like upstate New York. We're now on a piazza.
But Pieces was like, definitely filmed in America because they have American flags in every shot. So I'm sure it was here.
Yeah.
I just have to trust. Trust in Pieces.
So yeah, the big selling point of Slugs, well, one, the plot is set up just like Jaws, where it's two kids on a boat. One of them, I'm not even sure Slugs can live underwater. I really don't think they can because they do have to breathe air. But that said, some kid like dips his toe into the water, something pulls him in. Now we've got our drama on the boat. And then we go to Mike Brady, not Brody, Brady. And he is like the chief and he's like the health inspector.
Mike Brady? Like Brady Bunch?
Mike Brady. His name's Mike Brady. But he plays the Brody character where he is very much like, there's something out there, mayor. And the mayor's like, no, there's not. All these people that are dying with slugs all over them, it's nothing. It's food poisoning is literally one of the things that they say. A guy's eyeball explodes in the middle of a restaurant and worms shoot out of it. And they're like, it's food poisoning.
Wow.
So that's fun. But the biggest selling point of Slugs is always the effects. The effects in this are just absolutely amazing. Combination of actual slug action. Where they were using real slugs like that we have everywhere, just the common black slug they were using. And then with a mix of special effects. And the guy who did it, it's his regular guy. So Pieces, The Rift, which also has crazy effects. And then he went on to do Alien and a whole bunch of like other really, really amazing stuff. He made the alligator in Alligator. So yeah, the effects are just across the board. I paid a lot of attention to the score this time because it's all over the place. Like it opens with like a Bernard Herrmann string score. And then all of a sudden we're in like a 70s porn with like this crazy sax. And then there's heavy metal. And then there's some country music in there too. It's a blast. So there's a really fancy blue of it out from Arrow. Oh, I highly recommend checking it out.
With a wonderful seen that blue. I've seen the film like a couple years ago and really liked it. I actually thought it was much better than I thought it was going to be.
It's great.
Because the effects are so good. That was the thing that was surprising. I was like, wow, this is good. Like, this is a fun movie. So yeah, no, I would like to see that blue.
Yeah,
the Arrow one.
Okay. Yeah, the Arrow one has a really great booklet in it as well with a wonderful write-up from Mike Gingold. So I highly recommend checking that out. From Arrow, that is Slugs, 1988.
Well, that's cool. Something, huh?
Yes. I jumped onto Netflix and finally watched Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil.
Wait, that's
and
on Netflix?
Vile. It's a Netflix original.
I had no idea. I've been waiting to see it. I was waiting for it to be in theaters, man. Or whatever.
No. They picked it up out of whatever.
Netflix hasn't had much to offer me lately. So
well, because Berlinger had the documentary, and then which was on Netflix at the time that this movie was premiering. At some
And then they announced Netflix got it. So yes, it's on Netflix right now. Cool. If you don't know, this is Joe Berlinger's Ted Bundy movie starring Zac Efron as Ted Bundy. I think it's an interesting companion piece to his docuseries. The documentary series is about 4 episodes, and the first 2 kind of skate through stuff you've already known, and then the latter 2 are like great episodes. So that's just kind of the preface. As far as the movie, I know, Ryan, you saw it, and my memory is it didn't 100% work for you.
I was mixed.
I'm kind of mixed too, but I kind of get what they're going for. First of all, Zac Efron's incredible in it. He's really, 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 really good. And I think he captures what the whole point of the movie is. You know, it's based on a book from his first fiance. And basically, and I can't remember who it was. Somebody was on our show not too long ago saying that they read the script, and in the script, they don't actually say his name until halfway through. So like, if you didn't know that, if you didn't know that while you're reading the story about a guy that's being accused of things that are terrible, then you get there like, oh yeah, that's who it is. So that's kind of the point of the movie. Mm-hmm. Like, they don't even go – they don't go into any graphic detail. It's mostly during his trial, and it's mostly about how this guy couldn't have possibly done any of these things. And that's a weird take to go with. I think it's interesting. I love seeing Berlinger throwbacks, like the guy from Burn Notice and Blair Witch 2 is one of his attorneys at one point. I was like, it's good to see him back, you know. The entire cast is great. It's just a very strange – I think there's the morality that goes into covering a serial killer story like this where you're like, am I supposed to sympathize? Am I supposed to not believe or whatever? But there's a great – oh, and also Haley Joel Osment, the kid from Sixth Sense.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And I was like, he's really good too.
Yeah.
But there is what's cool about it, and it's not really a spoiler because it's based on real life events, and we obviously know that Ted Bundy did all these things. But I think the whole point of the movie hinges on kind of the conclusion, because it's basically an entire movie of this guy looking straight at everyone and saying, I am not responsible for any of this. And the way that Efron delivers it, you believe it. You're like, oh my God, I'm being railroaded or blah, blah, blah. And then there's just one moment at the end. It's the only moment where he inadvertently reveals, yes, I did do all this. And that's kind of
– that's chilling.
It's chilling. It's the linchpin moment of the entire movie. I'm like, oh, that's why they went this route, so that they could build up to that ending.
Yeah.
If it works, I don't know. I'm mixed on it too, but I'm leaning more towards that I liked it it was so different and it didn't really glorify – like I was shocked that they don't actually go into the quote unquote terrible things he did, because they are awful and they're well documented. My only gripe about all it is, like, once you get to the end, the one that, like, they do this on all based on true story things, but they're like these are the victims of Ted Bundy, and I expected what would have been a great punchline to that moment, that chilling moment, is literally seeing all their pictures flash, and it's not. It's just text for like 5 seconds of all these names, and I'm kind of like, really? That's
it feels irresponsible a little bit.
Yeah, irresponsible. That's the right word.
It feels a little irresponsible to. I don't think the film necessarily glorifies Ted Bundy, but it certainly becomes enamored in the look at how handsome and look how charming he is, and let's kind of get wrapped up in this guy's kind of almost, you know, stardom, so to speak.
Which I think is what regular people did at the time. And that's the whole point of the movie. Like you start to see women showing up at the courtroom, and it's like, why are these women here? It's like, they're
him. They're
fans. They don't believe. Yeah. And so I think that's the whole point of the movie. That's just a hard line to ride.
It is hard,
because or even the judge is charmed by him.
Exactly. But you need it. But I almost feel like... But I almost feel like, as a filmmaker, and I spoke to a lot of people that came out of the theater after the premiere, and they were a little bit bummed that and I kind of agree that there were not these reminders of just how sick and twisted he was throughout, just to like kind of ground you and go, yes, this guy, he found a way to charm his way out of the courthouse and jump out the window, and then he took off. And look,
he escaped twice.
Look how zany and crazy it is, but then let's bring you back down to earth and show you something. That is really wrong and really violent and very graphic.
The Mark Harmon version is excellent.
I love that miniseries.
Deliberate Strangers. He's really scary, so he also looks exactly like him.
Most terrifying version.
But just the way he would go up to people and just say, oh yeah, can you help me to my car? Or I've got a broken arm. He was so flirtatious with the law. Yeah. Like flirtatious with people, but he was always skirting right up to what he could get away with. That's what's so weird about serial killers. It's just like these patterns of wanting to be caught, but not. I almost wonder if there is a weird ingrained somewhere deep inside them, a morality to be caught, to stop, but they are overriding that constantly. I don't know. No one knows. That's what makes them interesting.
Mark Harmon, I loved his performance so much because he almost seemed vulnerable. Mm. Like, he brought a vulnerability to it, which made him seem even more charming. It wasn't just that he was this strong, handsome guy. Right. It was that he kind of seemed almost wounded at the same time.
Yeah, they're all going to have some sort of wound. Doesn't mean you need to forgive or be empathetic.
No.
But they all have some sort of weird event in their lives,
but
right?
But with the Mark Harmon character, or at least the way that he portrayed it, it seemed like a put-on. Like, he knew exactly how to bring a small amount of vulnerability enough to make it approachable. It was a really good performance.
Yeah, I would love just once to see, I want to see a movie from either, like, that survivor girl, the girl that actually survived and, like, having to live your life with that sort of ordeal. Because there's another Bundy. It's just called Bundy from early 90s.
Mm-hmm. Tiff Shepard.
And Tiffany Shepard plays that character that survives.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's the thing. It's like some of that, those details are glossed over. But
I'm kind of like, I'm tired of these serial killer biopics. I feel like there was a time in the early 2000s where we were getting them. It was like Jeremy Renner as Dahmer and, you know, all these other films. And he was good. Yes. But we were getting Bundy and Dahmer and Gacy and blah, 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 blah. And I feel like just because there is great talent coming to the table, unless you're really giving us something that's mind blowing, then why bother? Like, it's like, I'm kind of tired of Charlie Manson movies.
Yeah. You know? It's just, never want to see one of those again.
There's like no new angles to
except
to be
for
revealed.
The summer.
That's different.
We have no idea. None of us know what's different.
Oh, by the way, if you drive down Hollywood Boulevard right now, you'll see some viral posters for the new Quentin movie. Yeah, right. They look like spaghetti western posters, and it's just like Leo DiCaprio.
They're doing it for all the different genres.
Really cool.
Which is funny because he originally got criticism for kind of a generic poster, but it's probably because they had planned this crazy.
Of course.
I'm excited.
I think it's going to be fun.
I watched them shoot parts of it because they shot it on the street in Burbank. Yes. And so I literally I took Marnie out and we would walk down and get ice cream and then we would stand there and be onlookers. And we watched them shoot a bunch of stuff. They had amazing toys to play with.
We're talking about Quentin's new movie, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
But yeah, no, I think it was.
They had cranes.
I think it was questionable right up in the last minute whether it was going to play at Con or not, because I remember reading some article. Would it be done? But it's on the docket, so we'll find out what people think in a day.
Yeah.
I saw a couple arty ones. I saw one that I'd never heard of called A Reflection of Fear. It's directed by William Fraker, who is a very famous DP who has shot many of your favorite films, especially Rosemary's Baby. It has Robert Shaw in it, Sally Kellerman, and Sandra Locke basically plays this albino young girl. I think she was 25 when she was in it, playing like a 15-year-old. She's a shut-in in this kind of nice mansion in the middle of nowhere, and she has a mannequin that she talks to that is her friend, and at night that mannequin or somebody dressed like it is running around the property doing weird things, you know, destroying flowers, being kind of a nuisance. She fantasizes about her father, who's not around, who ends up being Robert Shaw, who's a famous writer, and he comes back to get a divorce, and he's coming with his new girlfriend from the mom, but such straight away gets total incest vibes, super weird. Yeah. Every time they're on screen together, you're like, oh my God, what is going on? She's totally obsessed by him, wants to be in a relationship. But every time she gets closer to him, this other being who could be the mannequin or someone else starts doing worse things, and it basically becomes a US giallo. So I'd say it's one of the closest I've seen to – it's a slasher film, but it's definitely closer to a psychosexual giallo. There is a film I've talked about a bit on the other show, Pearson, called Secret Ceremony, which is Elizabeth Taylor and Mia Farrow, and it's like a crazy. It was from that book, Hysterical by Kayla, the book Kayla Janice wrote on.
House of Psychotic.
Yeah, I learned about it from there. It's a really cool movie. This is very much in line with that. Yeah. So if that's something you're into, Sandra Locke's really great in it. It is on Amazon.
That's cool.
But the one that's really mind blowing, this will frustrate everyone because you're not going to be able to find it, is a friend of mine, Oren, gave me a file. Somebody gave him this file and said, you have to see this. One of the best films ever made. And oh my God. And I would share it with you guys. It's just I don't know how they got it because it's out of print, but it's the guy who wrote 8½ and La Dolce Vita for Fellini directed a movie from that same period called The Demon. And his name's Brunello Rondi. Black and white.
Wait a minute. From what era?
It's from like the 60s.
I think we had that on VHS at Slashback, and I just saw the cover and I was like, what is
intense. So this is one of the most realistic possession movies. It would be a perfect thing to watch right after Friedkin's Possession documentary that he made recently. So it's basically a woman in southern Italy, an amazing performance. Her name is Delia Lavi, kind of Shades of a Johnny from Possession. Like she just goes all in. She is a girl who, 16, 17-year-old in the small village where everyone believes in pagan kind of ideals because it's very religious, part of Italy at the time, and no one has much education. She believes she's being possessed by something. Yep, a devil. And in it, there is a scene about halfway through where she does the spider walk.
What's it called?
It's called The Demon.
This is not the movie I thought it was, but holy crap, this looks amazing.
And a lot of it's treated very realistically. It doesn't have a lot of stuff where, like, you would finish this movie and not know if she was really possessed or if she was mentally ill.
Right.
You're not going to find that out. But her performance is so committed. The things that happen, she's in love with a guy. He he's rejecting her. He just wants to live a normal life. So she puts a blood curse on him. So she's kind of stuck between like the beliefs of this town and probably something being wrong with her. But the way it's shot, it's utterly gorgeous. Wow. It pushes the extremes of like just what keeps happening to her. The way people treat her in the town is just awful. It reminded me a lot of the one I just watched a few weeks ago, Hagazusa, in terms of, I think this is, you know, this is a slightly better movie. This, I mean, this is kind of a little masterpiece, but it's a similar kind of thing where when the people turn on you and believe you are some way, you become that thing.
Yeah.
And there's almost no turning back from it. But what's cool about this movie is that afterwards I started looking at the actress because she's so freaking good. And I realized the next year she's in like one of my all-time favorite movies from last – so that Darren put us onto, which was The Whip and the Body by Bava.
Oh.
She's the star of that, which has a similar kind of vibe, which is, you know, kind of – it's kind of sadomasochistic and really intense.
Right.
So that was kind of exciting to realize. And I think she went on to be like a Bond girl. So she had a big career, but she is incredible in this movie. I don't know. I'll try to dig around to find out how my friend got this film. It's obviously not the easiest. I have it on some sort of format, you know, to share with you guys. But
right.
This is a movie that if somebody's out there looking at the rights, this could easily be a Criterion film as well as it could be a Scream Factory film because you don't really know. It doesn't give away all its cards and has, you know, the writer of 8.5 as its director. That's pretty big cachet. But this is something special, especially if you're digging deep into the kind of possession subgenre, because some of the things she does are kind of like the physicality in Scott's film, Scott Derrickson's film, The Exorcism of Emily Rose. Yes, yeah. I feel I'd be surprised if he hadn't seen this one because it's just got that same level of intensity. And I love that. I love movies that show you enough that you, like The Spider-Wall, where I guess this is probably supernatural, but you could also still believe ultimately it could be about somebody who's lost their mind and is feeling persecuted. Right. You just missed it, but it's kind of Hagazusa-esque.
Called The Demon. Hagazusa-esque, okay.
So
sounds awesome.
If you can find this movie, it's called The Demon, and it's really worth you checking out.
That's cool.
And also sort of the slasher
darker. Is this the wedding one?
No.
That's the thing. And it actually has shades of that too, so I would be surprised if that guy hadn't seen this
movie. Wasn't that called Demon?
It's called Demon, and this is called The.
But this is
making sure I'm not crazy.
This is Italian with a Palestinian-born lead actress. So it's just got some interesting. Gosh, it's really a unique movie. And that's a dark room, an 80s slasher that you're going to see next month.
Oh, I love
I'll watch it by, watch it by not next week, but the week after.
Yeah, okay. I won't say too much. I mean, it's fun. It was like, a, you know, if you're.
No, wait, I'm confusing it with Black Room.
Yeah, that's different. This is just Dark Room. It's about a photographer. Okay. There's a guy.
Vinegar Syndrome release.
You saw it or not?
I haven't watched it yet, no.
Maybe I'll wait till you guys have seen it just because it's, you know, it's, I mean, it's, you know, hey, it's for completists. You know, if you're into 80s slasher, eventually you're going to get to this one and need to see it. It's got some moments that are fun and campy. It feels. I kept thinking of you because it reminded me more of a Lifetime movie that breaks out into slasher moments, which is what they are now.
I should plug that.
Rebecca Lifetime occasion.
Yeah. It felt a little bit like that, but and some good mullets. So it had that going for it. But, you know, I'll wait till you guys catch up on that.
Great.
Well, really quick before we jump to the next segment, I'll plug the Lifetime movie because, hey, I have a movie premiering on Lifetime on May 18th, which is like tomorrow when this airs, which is now called Psycho Granny.
Yeah.
Hey, did you know that was coming?
I didn't even know it had sold to Lifetime. So last I heard, it was under a completely different title. I'll say we went through a couple of different titles, which is standard in the selling process. We shot under one. It went to another. And then literally, I'm on the treadmill. Monday morning doing my thing and my mom calls and she's like, oh, I just saw your commercial. It looks so cute. And I'm like,
cute.
Commercial. And she's like, for Psycho Granny. And I'm like, what the fuck is Psycho Granny? And then she's like, but it's on Lifetime. It airs this Saturday. I assumed you knew about it. Immediately, I'm on Lifetime. I go to the Lifetime page. Immediately, like the very first thing that comes up is this massive header for the movie I shot, now under Psycho Granny, airs this Saturday. They're giving us lots of love. The trailer looks awesome. I literally beat a woman to death with a tea kettle in it. So it's fun. That's not a spoiler.
Spoilers.
That happens
spoilers
in like the first 15 minutes. So yeah.
Does Granny come home? Because that was the original title, Granny's Home.
Granny's Home. And then we did some of the rewrites under the grandmother. And then I think it went to Lineage of Lies, which sounded really classy.
But they just went for it.
Psycho Granny, guys. Psycho Granny.
Who is the Granny? The Granny is from Alligator, right?
The Granny is Robin Riker. And she's fucking amazing. And so as people have been saying, like a Lifetime movie. Lifetime, well, first off, I'll say Joe Bob Briggs said recently that if you want exploitation cinema, Lifetime's where you go now. That's just the only place that is still so doing weird. It right. So thank you, Joe Bob. Yeah. But also, I mean, guys, it's a horror film. I shot a horror film. Yeah, it has a higher like body count than anything else. It is The Stepfather. It's literally cool. The Stepfather with Robin Reich.
I'm into it.
It's wonderful.
Everybody watch it this weekend.
This weekend. Cool.
Yay.
Cool.
All Let's right. get our guest on, guys.
Sure. Be right back.
Shockwaves is brought to you by the following advertisers. Fright Rags is the number one source for your horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. Brand new this week, an all-new Happy Death Day collection is available now, featuring new shirts, socks, and an enamel pin. Coming May 22nd, the first collection of officially licensed Hammer Horror, featuring a classic Christopher Lee Dracula, Frankenstein, and more. And our Shockwaves listeners can save 10% now at checkout by entering promo code WAVES10. Again, that's WAVES10 to save 10% off at checkout. Visit fright-rags.com for more.
Hey guys, next weekend, Elric and I will be at Phoenix Fan Fusion. We will be hanging out at a booth, and we will also be doing a ridiculous amount of panels.
They actually sound fun, because usually when we go to these things...
they actually sound
usually,
fun.
Usually I think they sound like a blast. We just interview people, or we host it. This is like us on topic.
It's one of the reasons that I love going to Phoenix Fan Fusion, because instead of just us interviewing people, which is usually a blast anyway, but this one, some of our topics include bold horror statements, best horror scenes ever.
That's the one
ever.
I'm most excited about, best horror scenes.
PowerPoints?
No, I'm not doing PowerPoints for this one. But actually, we are doing for the best scenes, we are showing the scenes.
Oh yeah, we'll see some scenes.
And we're doing horror social commentary. You're on one that's like representations of disabilities in horror. Yep. And so, yeah, there are just some really fun panels there. And while we are in Phoenix for Phoenix Fan Fusion, we are also doing a half of Shockwave screening at the Phoenix Film Bar in downtown Phoenix. And we will be showing Society. And
but only half of Society.
Only half.
No. Only the second half. We're going to leap right into the second half of that movie.
And this is on Saturday, May 25th at 8 p.m. We're going to show Society, and then we'll stick around and do a little post-commentary and talk about it. And then after that, you will have exactly 1 hour to get over to Dead Right Horror Trivia Night, which we're having back at the convention, which is a whole five-minute walk, so you should be able to make it.
I thought this was a holiday.
No!
I'm going to be worked.
It is so All much right. that we have going on in Phoenix next weekend, so please check out Phoenix Fan Fusion, both the convention and all the fantastic horror panels, and also the film bar for the screening of Society.
You too have fun.
I call it my makeup tour for Phoenix, because last year I totally like pulled out of Phoenix.
You mean when I went alone?
Yes, when you went alone.
Yeah, we felt
I
bad.
Was in hospital
Let's
Phoenix.
Say that.
I'm coming back for you.
Wow.
Go Phoenix Suns.
Welcome back. I am honored to welcome our guest tonight, Dee Snider. Thank
Hello.
You so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you. Good to be here.
I went right in, guys.
Went right Thanks in. You intro'd because you guys have history.
Yeah, Dee and I, we worked together on Fango Radio for about 5 years, probably.
I hosted for a few years, and Becca, was it, were you an intern originally?
I started out as an intern.
She was an intern.
Yeah, I answered phones.
And she was going for her degree in horror.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Which we just used to jokingly, not like mockingly, we called her Dr. Becca in anticipation.
Yes.
That she would get there.
And she did it.
And she did. Yeah. I know she did. Yeah. I know she told me there's more than one, but the only one I know. So
there's a couple of us about.
If I write something, I send it to her.
Send it to the doctor.
The doctor. And if she sends back and says, wow, that was fucked up.
Which I've said before when you've sent me scripts.
Yes, she does.
That was
I like
up.
That to me. I wave that like a flag. I sent this to a doctor of horror. You don't know her, but she's actually a doctor. She went, wow, that's fucked up. Look, it says it in the email.
It's on the cover page.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, Dee used to host Fango Radio with Debbie Rochon, which was a show we had. It was such a fun show, too. We had that.
And Tony Timpone.
And Tony Timpone.
Yeah. He of the Thousand Yard Stare.
but the consummate smile.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's almost Mona Lisa-esque. It's like a half
Tony, we love you.
The cruelest thing I ever did to anybody was the band Gwar performed on the show.
Yep.
And we had Tony sit as the single audience member in for the Gwar show. They're completely dressed. This is on the air, but they're completely dressed up. They're doing full show, and it's just Tony staring at them with that half smile, blank stare from seeing too many horror films. They said it was the weirdest audience ever. Dave Rocky, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, that was a trip. We had a lot of bands come in while we were doing that. Yeah, we had
Dr. Acula.
I loved it. They were like kids.
Yes, and I think they've actually became pretty big in the grindcore, post-grindcore something scene.
I remember at the time I was like, Dr. Acula, like, that's a clever name, Dr. Acula. Yeah, but they were really good.
What does that stand for?
I don't know. We had one. There was like Vampire Moose. I remember we had the Snakes on a Plane band come on.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. When Snakes on a Plane was coming out. Yeah.
I don't remember the name of the band, but we
got to interview Samuel L. Jackson.
Yes.
That movie came out.
Really?
A big horror aficionado.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, that was because we were based out of the Sirius XM building in New York City, which was just trippy always because we were in the Howard Stern studio.
Yes.
Yeah, and we called it the fishbowl.
Well, they call it because when you walk in, it's just this glass that everybody sees. So we would broadcast from there and film it. Paul Giamatti, got to interview him.
Wow. We had John Waters on.
Yeah, Shoot 'Em Up. Was that what we call Shoot 'Em Up they did?
Mm-hmm. I love that movie.
I loved.
Yeah.
And so Paul Giamatti, and I love that movie too.
Yeah, it's great.
Who else was in there with him?
Clive Owens.
Yeah. So it's Clive Owens, Paul Giamatti, me and Debbie, and you know. So we're interviewing him, and I go, Paul, how's it feel to be the Susan Lucci of the Oscars? And his face just drops. And Clive Owens' eyes go wide. And I go, nobody ever said that to you before? And he was like, no. I said, well, it was just an observation. It's just an observation.
I'm
sorry. Just a side note. Shoot 'Em Up is amazing. It was directed by a guy named Michael Davis. And before that, he made a really great little movie called Monster Man.
I remember Monster
Man.
About a monster truck in a monster truck.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's really awesome.
Yeah. So it wasn't the movie Monster. There was a movie Monster Truck, wasn't there?
Maybe.
Yeah, there was. Well, there was Monster Trucks that the big Paramount put out last year, which was about like a fucking
Cthulhu monster. Which my daughter loves. It's like an alien in a truck.
Yes. Okay. That's kind of to be confused with.
Not to be confused, because this is more of a little scrappy kind of slasher about a guy that's a monster that drives a monster truck.
Man, movies that I forgot, man. I remember Monster Man. That was actually pretty good.
It was a fun movie. Yeah. And that's the Shoot 'Em Up guy.
Yeah.
I love Shoot 'Em Up because it has a graphic sex while shooting scene. Like literally they are in the act.
Amazing.
And then it's like shooting
and killing people.
Is it Monica Bellucci?
She's having an orgasm while he's it's very intense.
It's glorious. I loved that scene.
Drive
so
Angry
much.
Borrowed that.
Oh yeah, Drive Angry. Has
they borrowed that, but it was in Shoot 'Em Up. First.
I've got to say that I totally miss having to watch every horror movie that comes out. having an excuse to watch every horror movie that comes out.
I remember that we used to go to the early show. I remember that some of the people called it the bum show, which sounds terrible now. But it's not PC at all. But in New York City, a lot of the homeless population would go to the movies the first part of the day, and then they would just stay in there and sleep. Yeah. And so we would go to like the 10 a.m. show on Times Square, and it was like me, Debbie, our producer Mike, and then a whole bunch of homeless people. And,
well, there used to be that $1 theater that was just north of Times Square, like 54th Street. And I remember the best screening of my life was seeing Star Trek Generations next to a very kind homeless man who I shared my popcorn with. Mm-hmm. And he was just like, this is like that episode of Star Trek original. And he was like picking out episodes and
hardcore
references.
He wasn't there just by accident.
Yeah, yeah. I was, but that was the theater where the homeless would go. And
I remember we would all go see movies in kind of a pack right before it would start, and Tony would come with us and whatever we were talking. I distinctly remember the Perfume screening because that one was very polarizing within the group.
Yes, but that's a great thing, was to be able to say, honey, I got to watch these shitty horror movies because it's for the show. So it's like, and then just sit there, and you know what? I mean, we went as a pack, but you don't need the pack to watch a horror movie.
Oh,
you just sit down there. Yeah, you know what I'm saying? It's even better. It's even better. Like, I'm going. I've already got. I had my tickets like 3 weeks ago for John Wick 3. I know it's not hard.
Oh my gosh!
But
yeah.
I'm like so. And when I was going to get seats, It was very interesting because virtually nothing was taken except for about seven center seats, single seats, just like in a row. You know, like already got my seat. I'm going. I don't care if anybody's going with me. I'm just going.
Now, I'm going to back up here because I know your whole rock and roll history because I heard you tell it on the show and researched it, and you used to work in a hot dog stand in Long Island.
Yes.
But I don't know kind of where your origin into horror movies started. So had you always been a horror fan?
That's a really good, you know, that question kind of came up a little before the show.
Yeah, yeah.
We knew we were going here. And, you know, and no, I was terrified of horror movies as a small child. And it was sort of one of these things I had to conquer. I was also terrified of bikers. And now I am a biker.
Do you still do Bikers for Babies?
I don't do Bikers for Babies, but I do my charity rides every year. I do a lot of work. I'm out of Sturgis many years in a row.
Yeah.
I've become a biker. Mm-hmm. So I've sort of, it was a matter of like, as a little kind of scared kid to cry. My dad used to call me a crybaby, to be honest. And, but he got smacked that out of me. Anyway, but I just sort of confronted my fears and just came to love it and make it a part of my life and a part of who I am, part of my brand, which is kind of strange. But thinking about what's like the first, not the first, but the movie that just like hooked me and said, I love this. Two movies, Dawn of the Dead, Scanners.
Mm. Yeah.
So that at that point, it really became an obsession. You know, before that, I'm like 19 or something like that was come out. So I'm already past the crybaby stage. But with those movies, it was like, fuck, I got to see more of this. And then the search begins, which we've talked about on the show.
Oh, yeah.
Where people who love horror will watch everything in hope for that moment, just in hope they'll find that bit, that evil dead. I remember when Twisted Sister was recording You Can't Stop Rock and Roll, we rented Evil Dead over in England and Jimmy Page's studio of all things, he's a devil worshiper. Anyway, and, we're there, watch this movie and we are literally, now we're like in our 20s and going, holy fuck, this is that moment that you hope for when you're trying every single horror movie in the rack. Evil Dead was one of those movies.
Yeah. So was it more music for you first, love of music first, that eventually led to films and vice versa? Because that's kind of how it was for me. I'd go back and forth. I'd be passionate just about music, and then I'd be into movies and stuff. So,
sorry I'm laughing. My water bottle is flashing, telling me I am
absolutely obsessed with your water bottle.
I mean, and it sent me texts.
And it's like, take a sip.
Yeah, it says, you know, what is there, a drought? It's sarcastic. And, you know, clearly you can lead a horse to water, you know, this kind of thing. So it knows I'm carrying the bottle and I'm not drinking, so the bottle's flashing.
Yeah,
that's
but
pretty
I have
crazy.
A hydration issue. I went to the throat doctor, said, Doc, I have some problems with the top end of my voice. And he goes, wow, you're really dehydrated. How much water do you drink a day? I said, I don't know, like 15 cups. And he goes, of water? I said, no, coffee. But
I remember the most.
Water
I
would pour it over the beans. Yeah. Doesn't it count? He goes, actually, it's negative water. It's negative water. You're actually taking water out. You're depleting your body of water. So
right
in
now.
Answer to your question, it's kind of simultaneous, you know? Yeah. I mean, horror and the kind of rock and roll I like started together with Alice Cooper. Mm-hmm. And I think Alice gets a lot of credit.
He's such a crossover.
Yes. Yeah. As an artist, though, too. So he was creating this scary music. I love the dead and sick things. And, you know, and so now it's like sort of, it's just all coming together for me and music and horror. And then my own band became its own thing. And, you know, and so just sort of, they sort of went hand in hand.
I was just talking about this with Brendan Small last night from Metalocalypse, how Alice Cooper, for me, was kind of where I see the biggest change ever. Because prior to that, we were seeing these kind of more natural aesthetic. And even in horror as well, we were seeing more like Last House on the Left. And everything had kind of this more natural looking aesthetic. And then all of a sudden, we see movies and metal at the same time going with this more kind of glamorized, performative, theatrical style.
Yeah,
Kiss
fantastic.
Brought into it. Yeah. Alice, Ozzy, of course, and then Twisted Sister and kind of the more theatrical stylings of it.
Yeah, and Kiss.
Yeah,
I mean, Gene, you know, but Gene took his stuff. I'm saying he stole it, but his inspiration was Alice Cooper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It really comes from Alice, you know, and he's the one who, and how, you know, when you hear his story, that's an accident that happened.
Yeah.
That's a happy accident. They wanted to be the Doors. Yeah. They wanted to be a psychedelic band, and they sucked. Just bottom line, they're just an awful psychedelic band.
Yeah.
And somehow it just, this thing grows and changes. And there he is, you know, throwing chickens in the crowd. And, you know, just the whole I Love the Dead thing is happening. You know, it's crazy.
Yeah. And so what were some of the movies that you remember kind of sticking with you as you were even going through Twisted Sister's kind of rise to fame and everything?
Well, you know, certainly I said Evil Dead was a game changer. And at that point, I mean, all right, so that's You Can't Stop Rock and Roll 1983. By 84, it's Stay Hungry. And now I'm just sort of just eating up every bit because it's all about, you know, videotapes now.
Yeah.
And that was a great time. We lost something,
yeah,
people.
We
lost something going to Blockbuster and just walking through and looking at the covers. I just saw an article on this recently. It was actually talking about Strangeland and just saying it was one of those covers at Blockbuster that they picked up. For all those reasons, oh, you know, that looks kind of weird. Hey, how about Linda Cardellini's career, huh?
Yeah.
From having her mouth sewn shut like becoming the next big thing. Anyway, but, you know, and you'd pick up just at that point, I'm just devouring anything and everything. And it's feeding into my music because the songs Captain Howdy and Street Justice on the Stay Hungry album became Strangeland. So, and I'm already writing like a rock horror opera at that point, which, just relax, everybody, you're never going to hear it. But that's what Strangeland was originally. It's supposed to be a rock horror opera. And I actually sat with Stephen King and tried to convince him to write the book. Stephen was really cool.
So I was going to say, how was that? Take us through that meeting. I'm very curious.
All right. Well, first of all, Stephen King, you know, he's got WZON. I don't know if it's still WZON.
I remember that, yeah.
But he bought the local radio station, and they play what he wants to listen to on the radio.
I didn't know that. Wow.
He had a whole newsletter and everything. Yeah.
It's in Bangor, the Zone. And so when We're Not Going to Take came out, WZON, which was technically a top 40 station, but Stephen was running roughshod over the playlist, just so I want some Ramones in there, you know, whatever he wanted. He just called the program director and they'd play it so he could listen on his radio station as he wrote his stories. Anyway, he heard We're Not Going to Take It. He wanted it added. It was the first top 40 station in the country to add We're Not Going to Take It. So he invited us to do these rock concert events at the local high school.
He invited Twisted Sisters to Maine.
Yes, to Maine. See, it's Bring the Mountain to Mohammed thing with Steven. He had the Ramones come up. He had Cheap Trick come up. He would promote these concerts, and then he'd ride his motorcycle. It's like a Kawasaki or something. It was nothing grand. Down to the sock hop, whatever it was. And in the gymnasium, they would have a big stage, and his bands would play. Now, he had heard We're Not Going to Take It. He really didn't know much more about Twisted fucking Sister. And we were really just out of the bars. We were as dirty as they come at that point. So we come into town, proud to say, band in Bangor. Bangor, yes, the mayor and everybody had a meeting. And Twisted Sister was banned in Bangor. So this said, Stephen comes down to the show to meet us, and he's one of my heroes. I was one of the constant readers up until the Dark Tower. I can't forgive him for that. Hmm. Any Dark Tower readers?
I got about halfway through.
Okay. I mean, I'm getting aside, but Dark Tower, the first one, I don't know what that was, what kind of how he was writing it. It was like haiku or something. So he tried some experimental writing, bailed on it by halfway through. And then it was like, okay. It's like, oh, it's two books. Okay. Second book. It's a third book. Damn. Oh, damn. This is like rough reading. Yeah. And now it's like he gets hit by a car. Yeah. Or that was the third or fourth book. It was like nearly dies. Never thinks like he made it right again. So what? He's leaving me hanging at the three books. He picks up the word processor or whatever it was at that time. And he's back in action. And it's the fourth book. And oh my God, he's a fifth book? A fifth book is dragging on forever. And now what is he bringing in? Wait a minute. Is that like characters from The Shining and characters from, you know, from Salem's Lot?
He's
in the book. And then Dr. Doom showed up.
Yes, Dr.
Fucking Doom.
You just sold this hard. I'm so into this now.
Is there an audio book version?
Can I skip to book five?
It was like, and then the kitchen sink came in. So after I got closed the seventh book, I said, I love you, man, but I'm done. I'm done. That was actually painful. Seven books over 20 years or whatever it was.
Wow.
So,
how'd you get banned in Bangor?
Well, we just went up there and said, all right, you motherfuckers. And that was banned in Bangor because that's how I talked at those times. And apparently I still do. So Stephen came in and I said, told him about, well, this is a really, I can't even go down this path.
When was this around?
I can't even go down this path because I can back up this accusation, and I love him and I don't hold it against him, but I can't even talk about it. I actually had it in my memoirs, and my publishers, who were Stephen King's publishers, said you can't that in the book, even though you prove it.
Yeah.
We can't do that. And I like him too much to do it. Yeah. Let's just say we had a conversation and I told him about my idea for, it was called the Horroteria, was Captain Howdy in Street Justice. And he found it engaging. But he passed on the idea of writing it. He said, I've been asked by a lot of people, Blue Oyster Cult had asked him to do something like this. He says, I don't do something like this. And I was like, cool. And that was the end of it. But, I love him and he's a big inspiration, you know, as a writer, as a songwriter on so many levels. He's inspired me. And despite my hate for the Dark Tower, I did write a song called Son of a Gun about the books. Not about hating him either. It was actually a good song, but it was a band that failed.
Who are some of your other heroes that you met along this journey? I mean, like, so guys like
you
Stephen
mean in
King.
The horror world?
Yeah.
Or music. Yeah, both.
You know, I mean, well, in music, you know, Alice Cooper and Robert Plant, you know, here's two of my biggest heroes, and they're like friends.
Yeah.
And it's just bizarro to sit and have dinner and conversation as a peer with someone whose poster hung over your bed, literally, Robert. And he knows that. I've been honest. I'm not that. And I would, like, every night before I went to bed, I kind of bow and then I go to sleep, you know, bow down before Robert Plant. And Alice Cooper is the same thing. So that's crazy. And then when you get into the world of horror, Twisted Sister had an ill-fated video called Be Cruel to Your School, which was banned by MTV during the satanic panic thing. And it was set, it was about a high school. Alice Cooper actually duetted with me on the song, and the high school turns into a zombie high. And so we reached out. We had money then, got Tom Savini to come in, and he and Michael Burnett, who was assisting him at that time. Wow. They turned an entire high school and so we had just like hundreds of students made up in zombie makeup, but it took so long to get the zombie makeup on them that we requested they go home for the night with the makeup on and then come back the next day so we could get a clean day of shooting. Yeah. So you had all these prosthetic zombified kids just leaving the school, going home. And one of them was one of the guys from 90210, the one who just passed.
Oh, Luke Perry?
Luke Perry.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my gosh.
Luke Perry was one of the extras. And like years later, my kids are watching the video. And my sister-in-law, because I do not know who Luke Perry was, but goes, wait a second, back that up. That's Luke Perry sitting in the classroom as one of the students. And there he was, just sitting there, you know, waiting for his big chance. But so, you know, out. But then I – getting into the world of horror, you know, to have Robert Englund be a victim in Strangeland, which is one of the like coolest things. It was, it was amazing. So I've gotten to meet a lot of my heroes over the years.
Mm-hmm. Before we delve into Strangeland, because I definitely want to talk about why that was the right movie at the right moment, the right step for you to get into movies. You did appear in a movie in the 80s, which was Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Yes.
And I mean, you know, this is Tim Burton's first movie. And yeah. It's a fun scene.
Yeah.
So like I was always curious how the hell that happened. How did Twisted Sister end up in Tim Burton's first movie?
So Pee-wee, for those who don't know, I'm looking at the age group here.
Oh, no.
I'm saying
we're all aware.
Oh, no.
Pee-wee is my introduction to you.
Okay, but no, not the movie.
No.
But yeah. Pre-movie,
I've seen the HBO special.
It was right. It was he was like a college thing. He was a comedian.
Oh, because he did the stand up on stage.
Yeah,
he was Howie Mandel was
offbeat.
In it.
He had a comedy special.
Yeah. A little dirtier than yeah.
It was
you
dirtier.
Know. Or not yeah. Howie Mandel.
The shoe mirrors.
There was a couple different people who were in it. Like Phil Hartman was in. It.
Yeah, Phil Hartman.
There was somebody.
The
cowboy was played by somebody famous.
Lawrence Fishburne.
Thank you. That's the
yes,
one.
Right on his TV show. Yeah, but before that, he was doing the comedy circuit, and he was just this weird, edgy guy. And I became a big fan of his. So we were both at an MTV New Year's party, New Year's Eve, 1984-85, and we were appearing there backstage, and we're hanging out, and we're both. I said, dude, huge fan. I put my little kid to sleep with a little alligator. You know, all the time. And he goes, dude, I love your band and blah, blah, blah. And we became friends. So cut to March of 85. Twisted is in LA. Iron Maiden and Twisted Sister are touring. We've got 5 sold out nights at the Long Beach Arena. Sold out. I mean, this is the heyday before it jumped the shark. It was just cool as fuck, and you know, and a band like Maiden and Twisted Sister could tour together, and people were into it. You know, it wasn't separated to hair band and heavy metal. Mm-hmm. And I get a call from Pee Wee, would you want to do a cameo? I'm doing a movie. So, like, it works out great. We can do one. Went down there, and I remember going on the set and seeing, I go, who's that guy over there dressed like you? And it was a guy dressed exactly like Pee Wee, except he had curly short hair. He goes, oh, that's Tim Burton. He's a director. and he did Frankenweenie, he says. I said, oh, yeah, I saw that movie. Yeah, this is like his first big shot at him doing a picture. You know, so a little aside on Pee-wee. So when I meet Pee-wee, he is like hanging out backstage, and he's full costume, full makeup, you know, because he wore makeup. But he's Paul. I got to go out there. And he goes out and does Pee Wee Herman.
Yeah.
I want to get him cut to a year later. I want to get him to be in our video. And his spokesperson says that Paul needs to transform into Pee Wee. And he, you know, it's a process that he. I said, fucking process? He was smoking a joint on the set at Warner Brothers and just walked out there and did Pee-wee. I saw it. He turned it into a process. Now he's a process. So he didn't wind up doing the video.
Aww.
That's a bummer.
Wow.
But I love seeing you in that movie.
Yeah.
It was my claim to fame for a while.
Yeah.
It really was.
So jumping forward, how did Strangeland come to fruition? Like the script, can you walk us through the process?
Oh, yeah. So Twisted has this fall from grace. And I wrote the Twisted videos, co-wrote them with director Marty Kollner, credit where credit is due. And but movie studios at that, because we're hot as a pistol, everybody starts contacting me. They want to know if I've got any scripts because clearly I'm in touch. Like I've got some sort of connection and I get it. So I am not even, the We're Not Gonna Take It video was just like, well, what I see, you know, the father yelling at the kid and the kid turns into me and then he blows the father out the window and then we do a whole bunch of Roadrunner stunts, you know, so that was the script for that video. So now I'm sort of then being on the set of Pee-wee's Big Adventure and seeing insanity brought to life, seeing, you know, whatever somebody could write down on the page, there are people who will somehow make it real. And I said, I want to do this. So I started, because it would be a lot of downtime on the road, teaching myself to write screenplays. And I start writing and writing and writing. And, you know, first thing sucks. And second thing gets a nibble and I get to sell the story, but not the script. So I'm down, living in Florida now. Twisted is kind of, is over. And I'm watching horror movies because that's what I do. And I'm watching Leprechaun.
That took a beat.
That's the greatest origin story ever.
And I am screaming at the TV, kick it! Kick him! He's a leprechaun! I'm screaming that and Chucky. That was another one. It's a fucking doll! You know, throw it out the window! I'm screaming, and I'm like one of these people in the movie theater who talks, don't go in there, lady! Yeah. So when I said, all right, I've got to write a horror movie because horror sucks. This is what, eight? This is 90? You know, when Chucky and Leprechaun are actually like,
91,
you know,
92.
Yeah. And I'm going, I'm going to write a movie. Okay, I got to create a really scary guy. Okay, think of a really scary guy. And then I remember, oh, I got a scary guy, Captain Howdy. And then I went and wrote what was originally called Helltown, the movie was called. And but this is the great, the character. And by the way, if you're paying close attention, you'll do some cross-referencing here and figure out what I was talking about earlier. The character was a clown. He was a clown that used his allure to draw kids into his house and killed them and tortured them. That was what Captain Howdy was originally. And I wrote the script, but gee, there was a book out called It. And when I brought my script with my original character that I put together, wrote in 1983, people were dismissing it and saying, oh, this is It, but with a different story in a slasher movie. This is, you know, this is Pennywise in a slasher movie. Mm. So, I sent the script to one other person, Tom Savini, who was a friend. And Tom, meanwhile, people are just saying that's why they don't like the script. And Tom calls me up and goes, hey, D, I read the script. I said, what do you think? And I got this idea that I'm going to star in it. Tom's going to do the special effects makeup. And we, you know, my dad's got a barn. We'll put on a show. And Tom goes, it sucks. Literally says to me, it sucks. And I said, what? He goes, it's really bad. And if you come visit me, we'll sit down. We'll talk. I'll tell you why. So I'm broke at this point. I get on a train from Long Island to Pittsburgh because that's where Tom lives. Yeah. He doesn't leave Pittsburgh. And I take a train to Pittsburgh and we spend 2 days together and he dissects it and talks about it and tells me it was just completely derivative. And I just, you know, take it from everything. And I said, yeah, but I had the clown first. He goes, that's the least of your problems. It's just a slasher film and you've taken from every, it's just, typical.
Yeah.
So I went home on the train and I thought and I thought and I thought. And I said, I got to reinvent the wheel here. And I said, what's scarier than dying and being chased and dying? I said, being helpless and suffering, not dying. With dying, there's peace. When you're running, there's a chance you might get away. But when you wake up, and you're naked and tied and chained and your lips are sewn shut and there's somebody fucking with you. That's my nightmares right there. That's my nightmares. And once I had that idea, I started to expand into the world of body modification. I was also very enamored with the internet. It was really pretty new when I was writing that, probably 93. So we didn't come out to 97, but I was with that for a while.
Was body modification that big?
No, it wasn't. Body modification was I was like, that was a world that I was exploring as well. So, so I invented internet crime, by the way. You're going to say, well, actually, D, it happened before the movie came out. No, but I did it before anybody else did it. So I'm on AOL for the first time. I'm going, man, you could really use this in a really bad way. And I think I know how. So I went in and I researched some young girls online, found some girls and then found their personal, because they used to have a, you know,
yeah, like AOL profile.
Yeah, profile. Then I created my own profile the next town over with a guy, put a picture, really cute guy, and he was had all the same likes and stuff like that. And then I instant messaged her. Is that what it used to be? Instant messaging, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, like that. And then we're talking, blah, blah, blah. And I go, hey, want to come to a party? And she says, yeah, where, when? Now I'm like in my 40s at that point. I reach over, I rip the plug out of the wall, and I'm hoping to God that no, I'm like, oh my God. I just got some young girl to come to my house pretending I was somebody else. Holy fuck, this works. And so I went in and started writing Strangeland using the internet. Oddly, some guy at Columbia University, while I was shopping the movie, lured a girl in through the internet, kept her in his room, tortured her and stuff. And I remember calling my wife up and going, some guy stole my idea. And she's like, what? I said, some asshole at Columbia University kidnapped a girl over the internet and he's been holding her hostage and tortured her in his room. And my wife says, in one of the most brilliant moments, she goes, do you really want to be known as the guy who invented that? Maybe they'll call it a Snyder. You know, and, today another Snyder happened. And a young woman was, and I said, good point. Yes, probably better if it doesn't come out. So that Strangeland was born.
Wow. And how long, once you had the script, did it take to come together? Because, and did you want to direct it? Because you ended up not directing it. You ended up writing it and starring in it.
I should have directed it, but I never wanted to direct it, and I never wanted to want to direct. The Shooting Gallery, who was this indie studio, yeah, did Sling Blade and Croupier. Yeah, they were like being very, very hot. They had a thing where the writer had to direct, and they liked the script, but I said, I don't direct. They said, well, then you got to be a producer. You've got to be involved in the process. And they were very cool that once they greenlit you and gave you your million or 1.1 million, they left you alone. And we went off. Me and Dave Buschel, who produced Eternal Sunshine, eventually Sling Blade, Get Him to the Greek. He did Dallas Buyers Club. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's a big producer now. He and I produced the movie, and I really got my hands dirty and had a chance to actually bring it to life the way I saw it, which was a really good thing. But I want to go – I need to say something. In case – this is known. But I'm just going to bring it up because this is my opportunity to have it be heard. My movie went to the MPAA in 1997, came out, and we were doing our fight in the beginning of 1997, and it received an R rating for scenes of torture. The first movie to ever get an R horror movie to get R rating for the first movie, Eli, for scenes of torture. And that was torturous. They were mortified by the idea. They had fully accepted people being slashed and killed and stabbed and shot and burned. We're cool with that. But they were making me cut out scenes of reaction scenes because people were suffering too much. I say, but you don't see anything being done to them. And they go, yeah, but it's just so hard to watch her suffering. Like, so that was groundbreaking at the time. And when Eli and John James Wan called into Fangoria, one of the first things they said was, we're not worthy. We love Strangeland. I know you love Strangeland, guys, and that's great. But Eli, it would have been nice if you just gave me a nod in that that show you did where you talked about the torture genre, where you and John took full credit. Just a nod would have killed you.
Wow. Now I don't remember because this is the late 90s. Was how did Strangeland do? Did it get a pretty decent theatrical release? And
terrible limited theatrical release. Mm-hmm. It was very little promotion budget. This was an indie release, and you know they did what they could. I mean, they really thought that my friendship with Howard Stern was going to pack the theaters. But I knew and never told them that Howard's taste in movies and music has no effect on sales. Zero. Mm. The bands he likes, and he likes a lot of abstract bands, They get no love. You know, people, his audience now, yeah, you know, Howard's got enough's enough on, but we're not buying their records, you know, it is, and the same goes for horror. So Howard was awesome. He plugged the movie. He had me on the air. I'm sure he went to see the movie and whatever, but it wasn't enough. But they did green light. The Shooting Gallery got enough out of it that it immediately greenlit the sequel.
Right.
And we went into the early processes of writing the sequel. And then they got indicted by the federal government. Oh, geez. And their CFO was arrested and imprisoned, and they seized all their properties. It turns out they were cooking the books. It's one of those, actually a documentary on the New York indie film scene of the mid-90s that was exploding with a lot of Wall Street money and a lot of that tech money going in there. They wound up getting shut down. And then I spent 7 years in court just trying to get my creative property back at great expense. And they just kept wanting, you know, the courts just wanted to just clear everything up. And one of the things they did, which really sucked, is they gave, it's Lionsgate, but it wasn't Lionsgate. It was Artisan back then.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
Artisan owed like millions of dollars in back residuals to the actors in all the Shooting Gallery movies. And they cut a deal that if the courts gave them all the movies in perpetuity that they worked on distribution wise, they would pay $1 million on the millions they owed and they would settle. So I got back all the creative, the characters, everything internationally, but not the licensing or distribution in the United States. So Lionsgate has that and they run it every now and then and whatever they get for that, you know, or they can sell it online or whatever in the United States, but
they've never done a Blu-ray or anything.
No, they never expanded on it. And, you know, they were talking with me about – so many people have been talking to me about doing a sequel. But it's just never – I must have like 7 false starts. And it's just – it's actually heartbreaking because when I see the shit that does get a sequel and I go, all right, even if you call mine shit, it's at least I would say it's – within the shittiness of those movies, it's no shittier.
I can make something as shitty as that.
Yeah. So I mean, want to say shit, yeah, but it's no shittier than they are.
Now, we did do a comic book sequel while we were at Fangoria, I remember.
My son, who is a comic book guy, wrote 3 comics. Fangoria comics, issue 1 came out. And then issue 2, that's when
I don't
Fangoria,
even know what happened after that.
It went tits up, yeah, as they say. And the whole thing fell apart. So that never happened.
But the
and
first was that, one was great.
Was that your script for the sequel?
No, my son, Jesse Snyder, who knows me, you know, and actually worked on the film. He was dumpster diving and working with the art department on the original film. He knew the story. He was one of my first readers as well. Although my real first reader is always my wife. Mm. And just want to share with you. Yeah. Now, I've been with Suzette. At that point, I'm with her like 20-something years. So I go, babe, I wrote this scary movie. And she's a big horror movie fan. I'm like, would you read it and let me know what you think? So she goes, comes downstairs a couple hours later. And she's holding it like it's a dish towel. And she's like, you got something you want to tell me? And I said, no, why? And before my eyes, this beautiful woman turned into Sam Kinison. Ow, ow, ow! What is that? Who am I married to? I'm like, holy, she's freaking the fuck out. Who am I married to? I don't know. I'm like, it's my nightmares, not my dreams. And she said, what? I said, those are my nightmares. I said, what scares me more than anything? Burning alive, suffering. This is my nightmares. I didn't write my dreams. I wrote what scares me. Okay. She calmed down. It was a moment. Our marriage nearly came apart. How'd that come there? Oh, yeah. So Jesse wrote a prequel. He knew the story inside and out, and he wrote a three book prequel. One was released. They were really cool, and really, you can see Captain Howdy getting his tattoos and piercings in place, sort of developing. Oh, cool. And unfortunately, they're just on a shelf somewhere.
I still have my copy. Yeah.
Every night, you know, I do these horror cons. Again, all these people line up for, you know, pictures of Captain Howdy and stuff like that. And it's great. Which just says, well, why am I doing all these horror cons? And all these people love Captain Howdy and love the movie. And I still don't have a sequel. And that's just like every time I do a Q&A, it's like, I'm like, okay, wait. Let me just answer the question before you start. And then I answer the question and everybody leaves because that's why they were there. Why the sequel coming?
Well, I'm curious, Dee. I mean, do you think that Strangeland just came into the world a little bit too early? Because when the movie came out, Hollywood and horror had been at the height of Scream. So you were getting Scream and Urban Legend and Valentine and all these kind of teenage slasher knockoffs. Yeah. But I feel like Strangeland, if it had just moved slightly to the, you know, 2000s, early 2000s, maybe it would have really, really hammered
home. I agree. Yeah. But, you know, part of the goal is you're hoping you hit it just right.
Right, that is,
you're the first out of the gate. You are the Star Wars before everybody else starts doing it. You are the Aliens people start doing grittier movies like that. And you're hoping that you're going to be, I'm going to get there before everybody else, and it's going to ignite something. Yeah. But the danger is that you could get there to the dance way too soon and just be standing there by yourself looking like a total dork, you know? So, you know, it gets a lot of credit for being there. And people, if you've never watched it and you do go back and watch it, just bear in mind, it was 1990. It was 96. So the technology obviously is dated. You got to go back if you were alive and realize at the time I had a flat screen monitor in one of the scenes. That was like unheard of. But we had to go through to get a flat screen monitor. It was like a flat screen. Yeah. I know they're making them somewhere, you know, and he's on the phone dialing up on the phone. It was like with a dial up modem on the phone trying to hook into the internet. It's like these were dark times, people.
That's right.
There are
other internet thrillers that came out long before you that look just even worse. I mean, it's like The Net, Sandra Bullock. You watch that, and you're like, what the fuck are they talking about?
I know.
I was writing the scripts, and as I'm doing rewrites, the speed of the modems is changing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I'm going from like literally a 2,500 to I'm moving, and I'm getting to the end of like a 57,000. Like, whoa, we're flying now.
Oh, yeah.
You know? But
everybody's racing to Target to get their AOL discs.
Those AOL discs. Oh, my gosh.
Well, I mean, before – I have a music question for you, but before we hit that, so, I mean – is there a version of Strangeland 2 that you would like to do? And how has it changed over the years? Because that's the thing, is like with the first one, you were kind of ahead of the curve. And I mean, especially technology changes so fast. So how much has your idea, your initial germ of an idea for Strangeland 2 changed over the course of the last few years?
Well, it's first, you know, subsequent to Strangeland came the torture genre. So the bar got lowered. So if I knew that if I was going to write a sequel, the bar was going to have to be really fucking low. So I got out my trenching tool and I dug a hole and I dropped the bar in it. And this movie is fucking sick. I mean, I delve into the world of body modification and also there's a lot of ritualistic stuff that people do that's just for like entertainment purposes, you know, for play. And I got some sick set pieces in this movie, which I have no fear of anybody upstaging me. But the story itself, you know, I started it like a year later to the day. And then as the years went by, it's now I started a rewrite where it was like, oh shit, it's 20 years. Well, fuck. If, you know, that's a lot of times gone by and some interesting things have occurred, you know, people are grandparents now. And I mean, things have changed. And actually in the latest rewrite, Captain Howdy's let out. In my original rewrite, he escapes, but now it's 20 years later. And after they let out it was like, they let people like that out after 20 years. So now it was like, whoa, you know, and people get upset like they did with the guy who shot at Reagan, you know, but they still let these people out, you know. So I'm taking a whole different, okay, it's 20 years later, and where are we now? And how's the world changed? You know, so, but it's been so frustrating to write and write and write and rewrite and rewrite and rewrite. And I just finally stopped. And I said, I got to write something new, you know, and hence a script the two of you have read that I think is going to be the next bar lowering. called My Enemy's Enemy. I don't want to talk about it content-wise. It's sick.
It's sick.
It's pretty gnarly.
It's gnarly. And I think – and I'm actually raising money to do it now because it's the kind of thing that I don't want the studios to – I don't think they'd do it. But certainly if they did it, they would just chip away at it and just – whitewash it and water it down until it was something acceptable. And I say, you know, why bother? It's a very simple movie. Mm-hmm. One location, as you guys might remember, I don't want to get too detailed on that. I'm going to say I can raise this money, make this movie, and then see if a studio like Blumhouse wants to release it. But Blumhouse, I mean, they're so mainstream now. They couldn't do something like this. I don't believe you guys could do this. I know you all work for Blumhouse. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. The one in play in the
room. I tend to agree, but I haven't read the script. But based on what you're saying,
well, just know that, that he said it's gnarly,
it's sick.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. You know, we do have that streaming.
I'm going to go on the record and say it's also depraved.
No, he hasn't. But it doesn't matter.
He just wanted to chime in.
Let me put it this way. Okay. I'll tell you this. It's based on true events, a crime that happened, and this crime is considered one of the most heinous crimes in the area, and I just started with this real crime and then turned it, even though the crime itself was fucking horrible. All I did is have to write down what they did to people, and that was so horrific. My constant readers maybe tone that down because it was just unacceptable on any level. These guys got 365 years consecutive each in prison for what they did. Okay, and so I started with that, and then I added a horror element to it. So it is so depraved what they did, that I put a disclaimer on the front.
She did.
That's it, because people were like, dude, you are really fucked up that you thought of that. And I go, wait a minute, I didn't think of that. That's just in the transcript from the court case. Oof. So I literally put a disclaimer like, I did not invent this shit.
Yeah.
I'm just documenting what occurred. Yeah. And it was so awful, but then I added a horror element in, which makes it different.
I think your script says the first 46 pages are all based in actual truth.
Yes.
You know,
and it's like, wow.
But then I read another script from you, which is almost romantic. It's like the soft side of Snyder.
Well, I got challenged to – I mean, I've written comedies. I've written all kinds of things. And
challenged by your wife?
No, it wasn't my wife. Although she asked me why everything I write is so fucking terrible. It's just horrible. And I said, well, it's not anything I write. It just seems to be the only thing people are interested in. I've got a new company called Twisted Storm, a production company with a Broadway producer named Michael A. Alden, 2-time Tony winner, 3-time Emmy winner. And we're both friars. And we were at the Friars Club and we're just friends and we're hanging out. And he's just under his breath, and he's the most menschy kind of little sweet guy. And he goes, God, I can't wait to go home and put on a scary movie and go to sleep. I said, what? He goes, oh, yeah, I can't go to bed at night without putting a horror movie on. It's like – it's how I wind down. I said, you like horror? He goes, I fucking love horror. I'm like, well, I fucking love horror too. He goes, I know.
Can we be friends?
We just become best friends. And we formed the company, and we have been creating different levels of horror. It's a couple of television shows. We're now looking to develop TV series, you know, episodic stuff, horror movies, the darkest being, you know, My Enemy's Enemy. But then played with the Walking Dead theme and sort of mixed Twilight with the Walking Dead and try to come up with something different that might have some crossover appeal. So that we're starting to shop that one, but I sent it to my first reader because I wanted to hear what she thought. Dr. Becca.
So, and your kids are now getting into the film industry as well. It's like the whole Snyder family has just expanded into Hollywood. Y'all were all music when we were in New York.
Yeah. Cody Blue, and his brother wrote a movie called Fool's Day, a short film, and it won 45 International Film Awards. Cody directed it. And then Hollywood was, you know, up his ass. 75 meetings in 10 days, where everybody, you know, from Bad Robot to Spielberg are pressing flesh with the Wonderkin. But, and then he got a 3-picture deal with Warners. So, the first Fool's Day is, and I can't really talk. I talked to you about off the, yeah. The level of people. They haven't announced those people yet. But, and it's a big picture and it's in development, not in development right now. They're getting ready. As soon as they lock in their, they've cast everybody except for their leading man. And as soon as they get the right guy, they go into production. So, amazing. Yeah, so it's pretty exciting. And Shane co-wrote it and Shane's, you know, doing more writing and stuff, but he's more into gaming and stuff. He sort of wrote it with Cody because Cody asked him to, but his passion is games and he just invented an, like his own, what's the card one that everybody plays?
Magic.
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 Yeah.
Like a role playing card game?
Yeah, yeah. He just designed his own and he's been working on the prototype. And it's, and you know, that's pretty amazing to do that because it's just so involved, you know.
That's awesome.
And they're creative kids.
Elric
hasn't said one thing. He hasn't asked me one question.
I said it was depraved.
Yeah,
that's what he added to the conversation.
And I love that.
Elric, you have a question before I dive in?
I mean, ask the music question first, you know.
Well, it's not even a music question. So here's the thing. I need to ask you how this happened because it was one of the greatest gigs of my entire life. A little context. Forgive me all for this story. I'm like 16 years old, living in Long Island, New York. And I'm a huge Nine Inch Nails fan. I'm pumped to go see them. They're going to play Madison Square Garden. I got tickets. I've been seeing them
since.
You were
there?
I'm going to
I know where you're going. Go ahead.
Yeah. So I'd already seen them several times and now they're at the point where they're playing places like Madison Square Garden. They have to cancel the show because they get in a bus accident, I think. And Robin Fink, the guitarist, like fucks up the tip of his middle finger, of course, or something along those lines.
Yeah.
So that's what happened. There's no Nine Inch Nails show that night. I had a buddy named Alan, shout out Alan, wherever you are, who's a little bit older than me, worked at Tower Records. He was that, we all have that one guy that's just a little bit older that introduces you to punk rock and metal. Like, here's what you should listen to. He calls me up knowing what a big fan I am. And he's like, hey, do you want to see Nine Inch Nails tonight? Like at a secret club gig? That was the pitch. And I'm like, yeah, of course. I thought they canceled the show. He's like, no, this is going to be something special and in a tiny little club. So I just hop on the LIR, take the train and meet him. We get to the city. We're in front of the Elbow Room, which is right next to Kim's Underground. And again, I'm 16 years old. The Elbow Room, I don't even think it was called the Elbow Room at that point.
Yeah, I think it was called the Rockridge Saloon or something like that. Yeah.
Saloon, 21 and up. So
Rockridge Saloon, right out of Blazing Saddles.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm out front and Alan is on the guest list and we walk up to the front and the security guy looks at me and he's like, wait a minute, no. And I'm like, what do you mean no? He's like, I'm on the guest list and this is my plus one. He's like, he is not 21. And he's like, no, I'm not, but I'm on the guest list and he's my plus one. And they're like, well, I can't let him in. And so I'm like, oh shit, well, that sucks. And so I'm just kind of like standing outside and I'm like, what are we going to do? And Alan's like, don't worry, we're going to figure it out. And I can't remember. I think Chris Brenna showed up, who was the drummer in Nine Inch Nails at the time, and he had a little bit of history with them. So he was asking me, he's like, hey, can you get my friend or whatever? And that didn't work out at all. And then finally, just like by waiting and waiting, Alan started talking to one of the other security guys at the front, and they were both big jazz guys. So all of a sudden, they're getting into this in-depth conversation about jazz and really vibing and like, oh man, have you heard this record? This blah, blah, blah. And then finally, he's like, look, my friend's underage. They won't let him in. He's my plus one. He really wants to see the show. Can you do anything? And he's like, give me a minute. And so he comes out 2 seconds later, puts a VIP pass on me. We walk up the stairs for Kim's Underground. So now I'm like backstage.
Oh shit. I know upstairs. Where this is now.
Yeah.
So now I'm
up there and he literally just rips the thing off. He's like, you're on your own from here, kid. Good luck. So I'm upstairs. I'm like a kid alone in Manhattan at this club. And I'm like, I'm looking around this backstage area. And I can't remember if you were there, but I know for a fact Trent Reznor and like Ricky Rackman from the Headbangers Ball.
Oh, it was just Jesus.
Scotty Ian from Anthrax.
Scotty Ian was there.
Yeah. And so I'm just like standing like, oh my God, what do I do? So I start just eating food because I'm so nervous. And then finally they're like, hey, the show's going to start. And there was like a little Marilyn Manson. It was the first time I met him.
Yep.
So like I'm squeezed down the staircase with Marilyn Manson and just like, hey man, I really like your record. And he's like, thanks. And before we know it, the place is so packed that I'm practically on the stage. It's the only place to be. It was on the side of the stage. And then what happened was it wasn't Nine Inch Nails. It was Twiggy Ramirez from Marilyn Manson, Robin Fink from Nine Inch Nails. And I can't, it was other people from both those bands and Dee Snider. And they played a fucking amazing set of like six Twisted Sister songs. It was like all the hits.
Yeah.
It's like burning. The place was fucking nuts. And like, I couldn't believe it. It was like, I saw Nine Inch Nails and Marilyn Manson back D doing Twisted Sister songs. Okay. And then it was over and the place was clearing out and Alan was all the way in the back. He's like, oh, you got in. And I'm like, dude, I was on the stage where he was like, I couldn't fucking see a thing. I was all the way back. So the guy that got me in, but yeah. So how'd that happen?
This is, what year is that about? That's
95, 96.
Yeah. 95, 96.
96.
Twisted Sister had died of death in like 87. And we just became uncool. You know, we got overexposed. And I had not done any Twisted Sister stuff since then. Mm. I had a couple other bands, Desperado and Electra Records, which got shelved, and Widowmaker, which couple indie records, and it didn't happen. And I just pretty much I'd stopped at that point. I get a call from Robin Fink. I don't know how he got my number, but it was Robin Fink, the guitar player in Nine Inch Nails. He goes, look, he says, dude, me and Twiggy Ramirez are huge Twisted Sister fans. We've got a night off. What would you think about doing a set of Twisted songs as the Sick Motherfuckers? And here it is. And like I said, we were just like a dirty word, a hair band. And now like the coolest. Oh, and they were playing The Garden multiple nights, Nine Inch Nails with Manson opening. So the coolest guys in the world saying, you guys are cool. You're cool. So I said, for this, I'll come out and do Twisted. I hadn't sung a song. So we go down to the club. We sound check. And like you said, it was just a short set. It was a secret gig. Word got out, and Manson's there, and Trent's there, and Anthrax is there, and Ricky's there. I mean, it's just a madhouse. Mm-hmm. And there's a side story, which is really cool, actually. But for me, it was just sort of like reinvigorated me, and just as them sort of saying, and people going wild, I'm going, all right, you know. I sort of survived whatever that was, that horrible thing that happened when hair metal died a death. And people are now looking back fondly on this in a positive way. So we had a great set. But after soundcheck that day, me, Twiggy, Robin, and the drummer, I don't remember who was playing drums, we go out just to get some dinner. So we're sitting around. And Twiggy goes, hey, do you remember Little Caesar's pizza stand in Coral Springs, Florida? I said, yeah. I used to get my pizza there. I said, and I'm flashing back and going, there was this kid behind the counter. He used to tell me he was in a band. And one day they were going to be like really famous and stuff. And I used to say to him, yeah, one of these days, kid, you'll be great. You're going to be huge. And he goes, I'm pointing. Twiggy points to himself and goes, that was me.
Wow.
And I get chills every time I tell the story because I see so many of those. I had that look in my face, that hopeful look that you just want it to happen so bad, and it happens to so few of us. And to meet one who made it through, and here we were playing together, doing the show. And I actually did Twiggy's wedding ceremony a couple of years ago, and we're friends, but I was just so happy for him because it's such a fucking difficult path. And here was this kid wearing that paper hat they wear. He's like, I got hair under here. He's trying to like legitimize himself. I had hair under my hat. They won't let me wear my hair down, and I got a band, and we're going to – and that was Marilyn Manson. He was struggling, you know? So it was really cool.
Well, you had the same thing with Adam Green, where Adam told you that he was going to – you know, that he was such a huge fan and that he was going to make it. And
Adam was another one of those guys. I've always tried to be a cheerleader. I never had really had anybody cheering me on. I just had people saying, it's not going to happen, kids, give up, you know? And so anytime I just think that's like my job is to cheer people on and say, you can do this. You can make this happen. Fuck these people. Mm. You can do it. And Adam was one of these kids who I ran into. Like Adam tells me, And I remember all the places, but I've been honest with Adam. I don't remember him per se because he was in a line at an appearance at a concert event or at a, at an in store for the release of Strangeland or backstage with a mob of people. And he'd come up to me and he'd tell me that he was, every time he was at a low point, he'd cross paths with me and he would wait to meet me and tell me his woes. And I would sort of grab him by the collars and go, get in there, kid, fight, you know, and just send them off. Yes. And he'd be like Bluto Blutarski running out of the room, you know, let's do it, you know, all fired up by himself. And years later, I got an email. So this apparently went on. I got an email and the subject said, hello again. And I didn't recognize the email address. And I don't know about you guys, but I get emails from foreigners and it's just like delete. And as I'm reaching for the delete button, it says again, again, hello again. So I did this. And did you ever do this? Like if I don't really look at the screen, I didn't technically read it. So I click on it and I open and I read and I'm friends with someone else. I don't know. He gave me your email. Okay. I know that guy. And then I start reading. And Adam just lays out this whole history of him meeting me at the low points of his life and me cheering him on to the point where he wrote me a letter once and I wrote back to him and that he had laminated the letter and it hung over his computer as his inspiration. And he said, you said in the letter, one day I'll see you on the red carpet and we'll hang out at the after party. He goes, well, my movie Hatchet is in the Tribeca Film Festival, is premiering. And I know you weren't serious, but I'm just letting you know. That's awesome. He put his phone number on there. So I pick it up and I call him. I said, where's the party? And he was like, what? I said, it's D. Where's the party? I said, it happened. The prophecy. We have to complete the prophecy. So I met him, pulled up with a limo, the red carpet, the Tribeca. Adam was standing there. I got out of the car with my family and, hey, how you doing? Met him and we walked the red carpet together and we did the step and repeat together and all the press and hung out at the party together. And, we've been friends ever since.
You brought him on Fango Radio for that as well.
Yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah. So, I mean, and you know, we've been friends ever since. And it's just, I love those stories. I love those stories of people who didn't give up and persevered and just, you know, and made it happen. And if I could have any kind of influence and somehow have be a part of that in some positive way, I don't want anything out of it other than not even a thank you. I'm just makes me happy to see that. But the best, the sweetest thing, it really was sweet. You know, at the end of the movie, they had the Q&A at the film festivals. And for the Q&A, Adam gets up and tells the story. And I had snuck in after the lights went down and he goes, and, this wouldn't happen if it wasn't for Dee Snider and he's here tonight. And I stood up and people were crying. I mean, people were cheering, crying, not at, for me. It was for the story and the beauty of it and, you know, and just the prophecy. So, it was cool. Adam's a great guy.
That's awesome. I will share this. Beautiful. I mean, I wouldn't be sitting at this table all silent if it wasn't for Adam Green either. Because weirdly enough, he did the same thing to me. I don't know if I ever did. I think I told you that.
I've never heard this story. So,
and I love, the show by that the way, you remember, I love the synchronicity.
Yeah. So this week in horror, remember the first time you ever heard? Okay, yeah. So I was on about 9 years ago. I just got to LA producing at the show and they were doing like a basic movie show. And I remember Adam Green was the guest on the show and I'm behind the scenes. And I just went up to him afterwards and I said, and he had just, I think this is right before Hatchet 2 was getting all the controversy. And I said to him, oh, you know, I really would love to start a horror version of this, but I wouldn't even know how to get a first guest or how to even start this. I wouldn't have a clue how to do it. And he sat with me for about an hour talking. And then he sent me an email where he listed people I could reach out to. He mentioned Mick Garris. It was like, he went like way out of his way, you know, right? Reaching out to me, doing exactly what he did.
That's cool.
And I don't even know if this, I think I might've told this once before a long time ago, but it's so interesting that, and I think it reminds me of when Darren Bousman talked about Aronofsky picking up the phone to a person he didn't know. When people do these things, they're throwaway in the moment to you, but they make ripple effects all the way across. So it is weird that Adams, yeah, definitely. And then obviously he was doing a podcast at the same place we were doing.
I'm so happy to hear that because I would have hated to have heard.
No, yeah.
And so I went to him and he said, Dick, get lost.
it's pretty
tough
wild.
Shit.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah. I was just saving this for the end. I'm like a Jedi thing.
No, but when I walked in, he was like, you know, holding court, and then he just went silent.
I've never heard that story. So,
well, Dee, thank you so much for joining us tonight. It is so awesome to catch up with you.
It's a pleasure, Becca.
It's been like 15 years, man.
I know. Yes, we look fantastic.
I think so. Hell yeah, we do.
You had two kids. I had four grandkids. At
oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, so that's the question. You know, people say, is there going to be another Strangeland? I think I'm still loincloth worthy, but I don't know how much longer I keep it together. So if there's any money people out there, now's your shot. Because otherwise it's going to have to be Son of Captain Howdy.
Well, I would love to see Son of Captain Howdy. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks, Steve.
And we'll be back next week, guys.
See ya.